59-year-old Sandra Prince had a reputation for being a kind, caring, and considerate woman who worked hard, played hard, and loved to share time with her friends and family. Notoriously private, even some of Sandra's closest friends didn't know much about what went on in her life behind the scenes, noting that if she wanted to tell you, she would, and if she didn't, you'd never know. Unfortunately, one secret Sandra had been keeping may have led to her mysterious disappearance. On the morning of January 3rd, 2006, Sandra's neighbor, gardener, and contractor all stopped by her Temple Terrace, Florida home. None of them had seen or heard from her in days, something completely out of character for a woman reputed to be reliable and dependable. Entering the home, the trio quickly noticed that Sandra's cell phone, which she always had on her, was lying on the kitchen counter, but there was no trace of the 59-year-old. Contacting police launched a massive investigation into Sandra's disappearance. For months, they questioned friends, family, and coworkers, trying to learn more about the life she'd kept hidden, searching for clues about who may have been responsible. After searching through her financial records, police learned that someone had withdrawn money from two of her bank accounts during the period of time in which she was missing, but it hadn't yet been reported. They released surveillance videos and a composite image of a man who concealed his identity behind a green ski mask. As the case seemed to be growing cold, police made a shocking announcement. They'd officially named a person of interest in the case. It wasn't a stranger, but someone close to Sandra, who was present at the house the very morning police were notified. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 191, The Disappearance of Sandra Prince, Part 1. Also in this week's episode, we'll explore the breaking news that an arrest has finally been made in the murder of 18-year-old Minot State University student Anita Knutson, previously profiled on Trace Evidence in Episode 137. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we explore the mysterious disappearance of Sandra Prince from Temple Terrace, Florida in December of 2005. In addition to this, we'll take a look at the breaking news that there's been an arrest in the 2007 murder of Anita Knutson. We'll get right into both of these after a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit crimecon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. Without further delay, let's get into the breaking news regarding an arrest in the 2007 murder of 18-year-old Anita Knutson. Was a student attending Minot State University in North Dakota. Anita moved into an off-campus apartment which she'd share with a roommate, Nicole Thomas, located on 4th Street, approximately a mile from campus. Wanting to support herself, Anita picked up two jobs to help pay the rent, and despite being an hour drive away from her family home in Butte, she maintained close contact with her parents and siblings. According to her mother, Sharon, the two spoke on an almost daily basis, and if any calls went unanswered, Anita was quick to return them. While everything seemed to be going well for Anita, there was one area in which she was having problems. Anita and her roommate Nicole didn't get along very well. According to Sharon, Anita complained to her that Nicole frequently invited men back to their apartment and oftentimes would leave them there unsupervised while Anita was asleep and unaware that someone else was in the building. Neighbors reported frequently hearing shouting matches between Anita and Nicole, and according to several sources, in at least one instance, things had gotten somewhat physical, resulting in Anita having her foot slammed shut in a door. As time went on, things grew worse, and Anita told her mother that Nicole had begun sending her threatening text messages. Sharon wanted her daughter to get out of there, but then, seemingly in the midst of a feud, things began to calm down. Friends reported that Anita and Nicole appeared to have found a middle ground, ending the tense atmosphere and mending their relationship. Things would take a tragic turn, however, as the summer approached. On Monday, June 4th, 2007, Gordon Knutson made the hour drive to Minot to check in on the 18-year-old. Over the course of the previous weekend, Anita had been strangely out of touch. Multiple calls went unanswered, texts were seemingly ignored, and she never called back. Worried with this being so out of character for her, Sharon asked Gordon to make the drive and ensure everything was all right. Arriving at the building, Gordon noticed Anita's car parked in her space, but no one was answering the door. Frustrated, Gordon located the building's manager and requested to be let inside. While the two talked, the apartment's maintenance man approached and reported to Gordon that he'd found something strange. The screen from Anita's bedroom window had been knocked out and was lying on the ground. A slash mark, apparently made with a knife, was clearly visible in the screen. Angry and frustrated, Gordon approached his daughter's window and peered inside. There, he saw Anita, lying in bed, partially covered by a robe. The mattress was soaked in blood. This was enough for the manager to get the key, and Gordon entered, rushing into the bedroom. Reaching out, fearful and emotional, Gordon felt Anita's skin, and it was cold. He reeled, trying to come to terms with what he was seeing, but also realizing he'd have to make that horrible phone call to Sharon to tell her that their daughter was dead. He quickly dialed 911. Inside the apartment, police found a somewhat confusing scene. It seemed clear that Anita had been stabbed to death, but the motive behind it wasn't so readily ascertainable. At first, the cut and knocked-out screen led police to believe they could be looking at a robbery gone wrong, but examination of the scene and items found indicated that nothing was missing. Was it possible that the killer had meant to rob the apartment, assuming no one was home, and killed Anita reflexively before fleeing? That much was unsure, but one thing they knew. Whatever had taken place in that apartment hadn't left any signs behind. While investigators knew Anita had been stabbed, they didn't find any evidence to show that any struggle or fighting had taken place inside the apartment. There didn't appear to be defensive wounds, and outside of Anita and her bed, nothing in the apartment had been disturbed. Curiously, while police couldn't note anything in particular which was missing from the apartment, they did recover one item which didn't belong there. The murder weapon. A knife was recovered from the sink, described by investigators as both dirty and bloody. It seemed apparent that they'd found the weapon the killer had used. A subsequent autopsy would confirm several details for investigators. According to the results, which have never been fully released, Anita sustained two stabs to her chest, only one of which was described as lethal. Further examination concluded that Anita had not been sexually assaulted, nor had she been physically beaten or assaulted in addition to the stab wounds. Toxicology showed there were no drugs or alcohol in her system. Ultimately, Anita's time of death couldn't be definitively proven, though investigators have stated their belief that the murder took place during the early morning hours of Sunday, June 3rd. Other details revealed by investigators have raised several questions, primarily in relation to how the killer gained entry to the apartment. Obviously, when Gordon arrived, the door to the apartment was locked, and it was presumed the killer had gained entry through the window, cutting the screen. However, examination of the screen itself showed two anomalies. First, some of Anita's blood was found along the cut, indicating that the screen wasn't cut until after the murder had taken place. Because of this, it was further believed that the screen had likely been cut from the inside and then knocked out of the window. From early on, police had theorized that the killer likely knew Anita. The lock for the apartment door was a twist and pull type, meaning that the killer could have exited through the front door, simply turning the lock before pulling the door closed behind them. Because of this, police were very interested in anyone who had access to a key. This was ultimately determined to have been only Anita, her roommate Nicole, and the apartment complex itself. Police had a series of potential suspects. A man living in the building who had an attraction to Anita. Her roommate Nicole, with whom she'd had issues previously. The building's maintenance man who'd initially found the slashed screen. And construction workers who'd repaired the building's roof, among others. For 15 long years, Anita's family and friends have watched in horror as her case grew seemingly colder and colder. While their hope for justice has never faded, hoping against all odds can become overwhelming when year after year passes with no new developments. Now, however, after all this time, the Minot Police Department have made an arrest. On Wednesday, March 16th, the Minot Police announced they've arrested Anita's former roommate, 34-year-old Nicole Rice, previously known as Nicole Thomas. Working as a civilian employee at Minot Air Force Base, she was arrested without incident and charged with felony intentional homicide. I'll now play a clip of this press conference led by Police Chief John Klug, courtesy of the City of Minot YouTube channel.
At about 3:25 p.m., 34-year-old Nicole Rice was arrested for murder and taken to Ward County Jail. Although most of the detectives who worked the original scene and investigation have retired, we have not forgotten about this case. Detective Carmen Asham and McKaylee Talbot were assigned to take over as the lead investigators. I wish we could have solved this sooner, but at the same time, I'm glad to say that we have a person responsible for the murder of Anita Knutson in custody.
According to multiple news outlets, Rice is charged with a Class AA felony, and if convicted, faces a maximum sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Rice was being held in Ward County Jail until last night, when according to court documents, her father, Kevin Thomas, bailed her out, writing a check for $120,000. Asked about Rice and rumors that she had been ruled out as a suspect previously in the investigation, Chief John Klug replied with the following.
I don't know that I would say that she was ever cleared. There was never enough to arrest her, but I would say that she was always a person of interest in this case.
According to recently released court documents, William May, an ex-boyfriend of Rice's, reported to police that sometime between 2008 and 2009, Rice had drank to excess and became belligerent. During a rant, she allegedly told him that she had in fact murdered Anita. At the time of the murder, Rice had an alibi saying she was home visiting her parents. However, court documents go on to show statements from her and family members being listed as inconsistent. One witness reportedly told police that Rice was at a bar in Russo, North Dakota, approximately 40 miles south of Minot, the weekend of the murder. This witness claimed that Rice left the bar, saying she was going to pick up clothes from her apartment. Rice, who was 19 at the time of the murder, has a daughter and got married just a few months ago in December of 2021. As of this time, there hasn't been a statement issued by Rice, her family, or her attorney. During this time, the Knutson family needs space to come to terms with this reality and to grieve. Reached for comment, Anita's mother Sharon told the forum, quote, "It's good in one way, but it's making everything come back again," end quote. As of now, this is the latest information available. I will, as always, keep a close eye on developments, and a longer, full update episode will be released in the future. I hope, despite the horrors of this case, perhaps soon Anita's family can finally find some sense of peace in knowing that her murderer is no longer free to walk the streets and is facing a long stretch behind bars. It's been a long time coming, and thankfully, it looks like Anita's family is going to see justice served for the hideous crime that stole away their beloved daughter. Now, we turn our attention towards this week's case, one which is still unsolved and could use every bit of help that it can get. This is The Disappearance of Sandra Prince, Part 1. If there was one thing Sandra Prince was known for, it was reliability. A creature of habit, she didn't make waves until the day she seemingly stopped moving altogether. Neighbors living on a quiet, tree-lined cul-de-sac in a quaint Tampa Bay area neighborhood couldn't help but notice her absence from the white stucco home with the bright red doors and luscious backyard garden. For days, the front porch light had burned night and day, but there was no movement. No doors opening, no lights turning on and off, and her car remained parked in the garage. The weekend had ushered in a new chapter for everyone as the calendar turned from December of 2005 to January 2006. At first, friends and neighbors thought the polite, sweet, and notoriously private woman may have decided to take a trip to celebrate, maybe up to the lake where she owned property, perhaps to North Carolina where her mother still lived. When the holiday ended, though, there remained no sign of Sandra. When her office opened back up following the three-day weekend, coworkers grew concerned. Sandra was dedicated to her job, and she'd never failed to make it in before, especially not without a call. While they began wondering where she could be, an unlikely trio walked into her vacant home. Nothing appeared to be disturbed, but the house had always been kept in meticulous shape. There were, however, a few things which stood out as bizarre. Most notably was Sandra's cell phone. She always had it with her, so much so that it was almost a part of her. She wouldn't even take a 5-minute trip to the grocery store without it. So why was it sitting on the kitchen counter while she was nowhere to be found? Worried, the three people decided to notify the police, kicking off an investigation that would span thousands of hours and hundreds of miles. Never could they have imagined that one of the trio themselves may not have been surprised by Sandra's disappearance, and instead might possibly have been responsible for it. Sandra Alice Hamby was born on Sunday, March 24th, 1946, in Portsmouth, Virginia, to parents Sidney and Dovey. Sandra would be the Hamby's only child, born 4 years into the couple's marriage. While Sandra was born in Virginia, she'd grow up several hundred miles away across the state line in North Carolina. Dobson is a small town in Surry County in the northwest corner of the state. Throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the population of Dobson never even approached 1,000 residents, though that would change somewhat during the 1970s. Sandra and her parents lived in a small home located along what was then known as Route 1. Through Sandra's early years, she was noted as being an intelligent and very loving child. Much of her early years were spent home with her parents or out exploring the wilderness surrounding Dobson, which helped foster her love of the outdoors. Her father, Sid, worked as a tobacco farmer, and it may be in these early years with her dad that her affection and lifelong interest in gardening began. According to her mother, Sandra and her father were very close, defining her as being somewhat of a daddy's girl. For his part, Sid doted on his daughter, and she was very much the center of his universe. While Sandra had a love for getting her hands in the dirt, she also had an interest in education, perhaps spurred on by her mother who worked as a teacher. During her early years, she scored high marks and was often noted as being an active participant in class and exceeding the expectations of her instructors. By the time she moved on to attend Surry Central High School, she'd established herself as a top student who made friends easily and was heavily involved in extracurricular activities. In 1963, Sandra was a high school senior already looking towards the future. In her final year at Surry, she was absolutely inundated with activities, with her yearbook noting that she was a member of the National Honor Society and senior class treasurer. She belonged to the Monogram Club, Drama Club, Teen Club, Science Club, and worked on the yearbook staff. She was also a majorette throughout high school, becoming the chief majorette in her final year, where she was also voted as Miss Surry Central. She'd also participated in and placed in both the school and county science fairs. Graduating at 17, Sandra next set her sights on college, matriculating at Duke University, which boasts the average student accepted possesses a 3.9 GPA on a 4.0 scale. For the first time in her life, Sandra was out on her own, attending Duke in the city of Durham, approximately 130 miles from the family home. Her parents were extremely proud of her achievements and relished when she'd visit on long breaks for holidays and on the occasional weekends when she simply just missed them. In March of 1965, Sandra celebrated her 19th birthday. It was a happy time in her life, putting the pieces together for the future she hoped to create and coming more into her own, forging what would later be described as a fiercely independent nature. Sadly, though, just 1 month later, her life would forever be changed when tragedy struck. On the morning of Tuesday, April 6th, Sandra's father, Sid, left the family home in Dobson to head off to work on his farm, noted as being near Mountain Park, approximately 10 miles west. According to the Mount Airy News, Sid and another man, Robert Collins, were attempting to unload a 25-foot-long pole from a truck to place it into a pre-dug hole. While lowering that pole, Sid was attempting to steady it when suddenly it slipped and fell over sideways, crushing him beneath. He was rushed to the hospital, but was declared dead on arrival, with his death certificate noting the cause as being a fractured spine, secondary to a fractured skull. He died instantly. A funeral was held 2 days later at Dobson Methodist Church. Sandra was away at school when the horrible accident happened, and it was a difficult time for her. Her father, the man she admired above all others, was gone. While for many, the loss of one parent might result in returning home to look after the other parent, but Dovey wasn't about to let that happen. She and Sandra supported one another, but education and building a future was something she wasn't going to allow her daughter to put on hold. Sandra would go on to complete her time at Duke, earning a bachelor's degree. Following graduation, she headed overseas, spending a summer in Madrid studying Spanish. Later, she'd apply and get accepted to a graduate program at Florida State University, moving to the sunny peninsula in the 1970s. At school, she'd meet and befriend Susan Horton, with whom she'd maintain a friendship for the next 30 years. Once Sandra set foot in Florida, something seemed to change, and she'd spend the rest of her life living in and around the Bay Area. She had always had a desire to help others, and throughout much of her college career, she focused on finding a way to spend the rest of her life trying to contribute something positive to those who needed it most. Graduating from FSU with a master's in social work, she wasted little time in getting practical experience. She picked up work at the Salvation Army, who, at the time, provided the only alcohol and drug treatment program in the state. Here, she would meet others who shared her dreams and values, wanting to provide better care for those who needed it. She began working with a group who decided to build their own system, which would become known as the Agency for Community Treatment Services, or ACTS. On Wednesday, December 21st, 1977, at the age of 31, Sandra married for the second time to a man named Luke Horvath. While I looked everywhere I couldn't find anything about her first marriage other than the fact that it was short-lived and she came out of it with the last name Prince. At the time, Sandra was very much in love and excited about a future with Luke, though their marriage would end amicably a decade later, in 1987. Just 1 year after she'd been married, in 78, ACTS officially launched, and Sandra was very much involved, being listed as a co-founder and helping to form the standards and treatment options by which the group would operate. She'd spend nearly the next 30 years of her life working for ACTS, making her way up the ladder, where she established a reputation for having a deep concern for patients, wanting to ensure they received all of the help they needed. Hayward Davis, a program administrator for ACTS, would later tell the St. Petersburg Times, quote, "She always stressed how we treat our clients, not to look down on them, but to treat them with dignity and respect," end quote. It was with dignity and proper care in mind that Sandra would help shape and forge the direction of ACTS for the next three decades. By the winter of 2005, Sandra was 59 years old and still working at ACTS, where she had risen through the ranks to a top-level administration position overseeing professional development. Regardless of her job title, she continued to be heavily involved in how the program was run and was hands-on in working with clients. Twice divorced and having no children, Sandra lived alone in a new home purchased 5 years earlier in Temple Terrace, a city in northeastern Hillsborough County adjacent to Tampa. She loved everything about her new place. The quiet calm she felt there, the large red double front door, and especially her backyard garden. The four-bedroom, three-bathroom, white stucco house was set along the eastern side of Moffett Place, a tree-dotted cul-de-sac where neighbors became friends and grew familiar with one another's schedules. On the rare instances in which a new car came down the road, there would almost assuredly be one or two neighbors watching from their windows, jotting down the license plate. Sandra made friends with several neighbors, though much like her coworkers, they would note her as being very protective of her privacy. She was polite and kind, described by at least one friend as a leftover hippie with a positive attitude and a soothing personality. Several neighbors, speaking to the Tampa Bay Times, painted a vivid portrait of the woman, a thoughtful person who enjoyed simple pleasures, someone who preferred to read rather than watching a television so much so that she didn't even own one. She showed her appreciation and affection for others through gifts and thank you notes, whether she was giving out candy for Valentine's Day or poinsettia plants on Christmas, she never forgot anyone. It was fairly common for Sandra to write thank you notes, giving them out to everyone from her massage therapist to the clerk at the local shop who helped her choose a new top. While much of Sandra's personality and behavior hadn't changed a great deal over the previous 30 years, friends did notice a few differences in more recent years. Known for most of her life as a casual dresser, frequently seen in jeans and t-shirts, she began adjusting her style, wearing more makeup, trading in ripped denim for silk dresses, and adorning herself with jewelry. Beyond fashion, she'd also been changing up her diet and health regimen, taking an interest in health foods and herbal medicines. Rose Ferlita, a friend for three decades and a member of the Tampa City Council, recalled to the Times how Sandra had even begun suggesting that she should try some natural treatments and herbal medicines. She was getting older, and perhaps, as some have speculated, with her 60th birthday approaching, she started to realize that while the clock was running, it wasn't over yet, and she wanted to get in some more living before age caught up with her. During her time in Florida, Sandra had worked to expand her finances by investing in real estate. By 2005, she owned more than a dozen properties, some of which she co-owned with business partners. She invested in rental properties and even owned some Section 8 housing where she kept in close contact with the tenants, making sure all of their needs were met. One of her renters, Shirley Godfrey, later told the Times that she, quote, just loved her. She fixed anything I asked her to, end quote. 60 miles north of Tampa in Sumter County is Lake Panasoffkee, one of Sandra's favorite places to spend time relaxing and exploring her ever-growing relationship with nature. Ultimately, she'd go on to purchase 10 properties around the lake, hiring on crews to update the homes and clear land. On one particular parcel, Sandra hoped to have a home constructed for her own use, a place she may have been considering retiring to one day. When all was said and done, between investments and properties, Sandra accrued an estate valued at approximately $2.8 million. She co-owned some of the Lake Panasoffkee properties with Earl Pippin, a general contractor working out of the Tampa area who she'd met through a business contact. In Hillsborough County, she shared ownership of several homes with John Morocco, the executive director of ACTS. Others she co-owned with Jeffrey Haynes, then head of the Tampa nonprofit Haynes Service Corp. She also co-owned some land with her mother Dovey, who at the time was 91 years old and living in Boone, North Carolina. Mother and daughter kept in frequent contact, having weekly phone calls scheduled for Wednesdays, and Sandra would make the trip up to North Carolina every 2 months. Everything seemed to be going Sandra's way. She was happy, free to live her life the way she saw fit, and she was making bigger plans for the future. What no one knew at the time, however, was that Sandra was keeping at least one big secret, and many believe that secret may have led to her disappearance. On Friday, December 23, 2005, Sandra attended a holiday party at the home of her neighbor, Debbie Bowles. According to Debbie, everything seemed fine, and Sandra appeared happy and excited for the holiday and the dawning of a new year. According to everything that we know, that weekend went off without a hitch, and Sandra had a pleasant, quiet Christmas at home. The following week, she was back to work at Axe, though with New Year's looming, it would be a busy week with everyone trying to catch up before the end. According to several coworkers, the last time they recall seeing Sandra in the office was on Friday, December 30th, though they couldn't be 100% sure because she worked in the field a lot. Due to the holiday, the office would be closed on Monday, granting everyone a three-day weekend to celebrate, and for her part, it seems, Sandra had plans on driving north to one of her properties on Lake Panasoffkee. Whether or not she ever made this trip, or even attempted to, remains a mystery, as sometime before the start of 2006, she would seemingly vanish into thin air. We'll get back into the case after a few quick words from this week's sponsors. I think we've all seen commercials and visited sites that offer DNA tests to unlock the mysteries of our pasts. While that's always a fun and interesting thing to do, it's not uncommon to receive surface-level results leaving you wanting more answers. And that's where GenomeLink comes in. GenomeLink aims to help people get the most value out of their genetic results. GenomeLink doesn't perform DNA tests. Instead, they use those test results to provide more in-depth information based on that person's genetics. GenomeLink has a team of dedicated researchers who have curated over 10,000 genetic studies to build a database and algorithm for accurate DNA genetic testing. In layman's terms, they're working hard to stay ahead of the curve with the most recent developments in the genomics field and to help you connect with the most recent and relevant genetic research. Don't just settle for your basic DNA analysis. Upload your DNA test results from anywhere like Ancestry, 23andMe, or MyHeritage and find out what makes you, well, you. We all know that DNA testing has helped solve many unsolved crimes. GenomeLink can provide you with in-depth information about yourself and your ancestry. GenomeLink analyzes your raw DNA data and gives you access to many more results and information that isn't provided by companies when you get your original DNA test. Personal trait reports provide you with personalized advice for fitness, nutrition, mental well-being, and even skincare. GenomeLink is set up in accordance with the requirements of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, the federal level security standards for safeguarding protected health information, so your information is safe and secure. Discover your full genetic potential by uploading your existing DNA test results at genomelink.io. Get access to over 25 free trait reports and receive your results instantly. No trial period, no credit card, and no hidden fees. Go to genomelink.io. Sign up today and discover your full genetic potential. This episode is sponsored by Surfshark. Have you ever noticed that it seems like the internet is getting more dangerous by the second? Well, that's because it is. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move, and malware is hiding all over the web. Luckily, there's a solution. You can get a VPN. A VPN will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and target. But privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you can forget about geo restrictions. You ever watch a video and get confronted by a message that it isn't available in your area? Well, with Surfshark, you'll be able to access everything from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. So try Surfshark risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/trace. Enter promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. That's surfshark.deals/trace. Use promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. surfshark.deals/trace, promo code TRACE. I love that sound. The sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. I love how Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed, from down the street to around the globe. Like mine, Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses, from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/trace, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/trace right now. On the morning of Wednesday, December 28th, 47-year-old David Jarrett was on his way to Home Depot when he placed a call to Sandra. At the time, Jarrett was working as Sandra's gardener and was planning to purchase a Christmas present for her, in addition to her garden. Just before 7 a.m., he called, but there was no answer. This wasn't necessarily cause for alarm, so Jarrett purchased a plant and began driving towards the Temple Terrace home. When he arrived, Jarrett noted that Sandra's car was parked in the garage, though he received no answer when he knocked on the door and rang the bell. Wanting to surprise her with the gift, he stowed the plant away in her bushes before entering the garage, where the two kept a journal by which they'd exchange messages and leave one another notes. Jarrett then called Sandra's cell phone again, but once again, he received no answer. He then left the residence and headed home. The following day, Thursday, December 29th, Jarrett returned to Sandra's house after she failed to call him back and was still not answering her phone. After repeated knocks, he finally decided to enter the house with a key that Sandra had previously given him. He found the house in good shape, neat and orderly, though there were two details that stuck out in his head as bizarre. Firstly, he found Sandra's cell phone sitting on the kitchen counter. This was out of character for the 59-year-old who almost always had her phone clipped to her belt. Making his way towards the bedroom, Jarrett didn't notice anything obviously out of place, though he did see a white Bible lying on her bed, which was a bit strange. Moving to the garage, which is connected to the house, Jarrett checked the journal, but noticed that Sandra hadn't yet written a response to his report from the previous day. Unsure of what was going on, and assuming that maybe his boss had gone up to the lake for the weekend, he didn't think much else of it. But when he arrived home, he just couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. Speaking with his wife, Marcia, he explained the situation and the two agreed to stop by the house together the following day. On Friday, December 30th, Jarrett and Marcia arrived at Moffitt Place and found the house in the same condition it had been the previous day. There was no sign of Sandra nor any indications that she'd been at the home since Jarrett entered the house earlier. Concerned, Jarrett visited Sandra's neighbor and friend, Nancy Sackville, and explained the situation. While both felt something was a bit off, neither was willing to, at the time, call police, as they didn't want to stir up a search when, in all reality, it was entirely possible that Sandra was just enjoying herself at the lake and had either forgotten or purposefully had left her phone behind. Either way, Nancy agreed to keep an eye on the house and to let Jarrett know if she saw Sandra or anyone else. Following the holiday weekend, Jarrett returned to the home on Tuesday, January 3rd. Entering the house, he found it in much the same shape as it had been during his previous three visits. Entering the garage from an inside door, Jarrett noticed something new. A note stuck to the windshield of Sandra's car. Speaking to the Times, Jarrett recalled the note reading something along the lines of, "Sorry, I had to disconnect your battery because the alarm went off. Earl." In that moment, Earl Pippin came walking into the garage, startling Jarrett. Prior to this day, Jarrett recalled having seen Pippin around once or twice, but he didn't really know him well. Asked what he was doing there, Earl reportedly told Jarrett that he was looking for a pipe wrench he'd left behind the last time he'd done work at Sandra's house. While the two men were talking, Nancy Sackville entered the garage to find out whether or not they'd seen Sandra, and they hadn't. So Nancy decided to try and locate Sandra's mother's phone number to find out if maybe she'd gone to North Carolina to be with her for New Year's. Finding the number, both Nancy and Jarrett spoke to Dovey, and while she stated that her daughter wasn't there, she started growing confused by the questions she was being asked. Thinking it might be a prank call, she hung up. After that, Nancy decided they'd waited long enough, and it was time to get the authorities involved. Jarrett dialed up the Temple Terrace Police Department and explained the situation, saying he wanted to report his employer and friend missing. While Jarrett was speaking to the police, Pippin told Nancy that he was going to swing by the offices of Acts to see if Nancy was at work. The office, located on North 56th Street, was just over 5 miles from the Temple Terrace home and would be a quick trip. Pippin drove away before police arrived, and a short time later called Nancy and Jarrett, explaining that Sandra wasn't at work, but he wouldn't be returning to the house. He had to get his son to a doctor's appointment, and he'd check in with them later. Jarrett and Nancy also placed a call to Sandra's office, but were informed by a coworker that she hadn't shown up for work that day, something that was very much out of character for her. Temple Terrace police arrived at the home a short time later and spoke to both Nancy and Jarrett. Nancy explained that she was very familiar with Sandra's comings and goings, and it was highly unusual of her to not be home for several days in a row without telling someone. Nancy had a key to the house and was close to Sandra, later telling police that if she were going out of town, she'd have told her in advance. Police were then granted entry to the home and started looking around for any indications of what might be going on. In an initial report to the media, Temple Terrace spokesperson Paula McDonald noted that investigators had found the home's back door had been left closed, but not locked, and the porch light had been burning. They found no signs of forced entry, nor any indications that a struggle had taken place in or around the home. While no items appeared to have been stolen, investigators did note they had been unable to locate Sandra's purse, despite the fact that her cell phone had been left behind. After contacting Sandra's boss and mother, her case was classified as that of a missing person, and her home was labeled as a crime scene. All windows and entryways were sealed with red tape, and yellow police line was put across all the doorways. In hopes that Sandra might return, or perhaps someone who might have information about her disappearance would appear, patrol officers were assigned to monitor the home 24 hours a day. Detectives were sent down to the Acts offices to interview coworkers in hopes of determining where Sandra might be. While she was now a missing person, they couldn't completely rule out the possibility that she might have gone off on her own for the holiday and perhaps had run into an issue which had delayed her return. Executive Director John Morocco described Sandra to investigators as a brilliant woman who was friendly, but private. If indeed she had plans for the weekend, it wouldn't be surprising if she hadn't told anyone about them. Julie Reynolds, an attorney employed by Axe and a friend of Sandra's, couldn't remember when the last time was that she'd seen the 59-year-old, other than that it had been during the week before New Year's. Either way, it was unlike Sandra to not show up and very bizarre of her to not call, with Reynolds later telling the Times, quote, "This was a big part of her life. It's not something she would just walk away from," end quote. After speaking with coworkers, investigators moved into Sandra's office and began going through her computer and files in hopes of finding something to work with. After completing their search, the office was locked and sealed with a notice that no one was to enter the room without authorization from investigators. While detectives were focusing in on Sandra's job, others had begun canvassing the Temple Terrace neighborhood, hoping to gain more insight into the missing woman's patterns and to learn more about her everyday life. They'd quickly come to realize that, as fiercely private as she was, very few people knew intimate details. Was she seeing anyone? Was there someone she was afraid of or had problems with? These questions would almost always result in the same answer. She never really talked about those things. Debbie Bowles, when speaking to reporters, explained that she hadn't seen or heard anything to make her believe that Sandra had been in any kind of danger or concerned about anyone in particular. She explained, quote, "No red flags, no nothing. She's just gone. It's not like Sandra to leave town without telling someone," end quote. The only solid information gleaned at the time was that Sandra had made a few off-the-cuff comments about possibly going out of town on New Year's weekend, likely to Lake Panasoffkee. But with her car still being in the garage, investigators had to wonder, had she made the drive and returned home, disappearing sometime after the weekend, or had she never made the trip at all? In hopes that someone may have seen her that weekend, police issued a statement asking for assistance from the public. On Wednesday, January 4th, police requested that anyone who might have seen her or her vehicle in the previous days to please contact them. They described her car as a white, four-door, 1994 Buick Park Avenue with a Florida State University license plate reading SHP, her initials. Specifically, they were looking for anyone who may have seen the car on or near the I-75 corridor during or after New Year's weekend. Police managed to get in touch with Dovey around this same time, though she wasn't able to offer up much information to assist in the search for her daughter. Speaking to the Times, she stated, quote, "I just can't imagine anyone, anybody, wanting to hurt her. I hope they find her, and I hope they find her safe. If she had any enemies, I never heard her mention it," end quote. Investigators continued to interview people in Sandra's life, looking for anyone who might be able to help them in forming a sharper image of what her day-to-day life entailed beyond work and casual conversations. Susan Horton and her husband Jeffrey were the first who were able to provide a slight glimpse into Sandra's private life. According to Jerry, he and Susan had known Sandra for close to 30 years and used to spend a lot of time with her and her ex-husband. The last time they saw her was a few weeks earlier in mid-December, and Sandra had dropped a little bit of a bombshell on them. She was seeing someone. Knowing better than to pry, the Hortons didn't ask too many questions. They never learned his name, but Sandra did reveal it was someone she owned property with around Lake Panasoffkee. Checking property records, police found that Earl Pippin co-owned properties with Sandra in that area. The Tampa Bay Times managed to reach Pippin on Saturday, January 7th, to ask about his relationship with Sandra. At the time, he said that he didn't co-own anything with her and that he'd simply done contracting work for her in the past, noting that he owned several properties in the lake area. When asked about a romantic relationship between the two, Pippin denied being involved with Sandra in any way outside of business. At the time, I should note, Pippin was married and had been for 20 years. Around the same time Pippin was speaking to reporters, deputies from the Sumpter County Sheriff's Office were executing a search at one of Sandra's properties by the lake. Lieutenant Bobby Carruthers told reporters that several deputies had taken cadaver dogs to search around 4746 County Road 300. What, if anything, was found at the time was not revealed. On Monday, January 9th, Sandra's family issued a statement in which they described her as a responsible person devoted to her family and career. They noted that going off without notice is something Sandra simply wouldn't do, and they couldn't understand what was going on. They also announced that they were putting up $50,000 as a reward for information leading to Sandra or to the arrest of anyone who may have been involved in her disappearance. At this time, Temple Terrace police also stated that after utilizing cadaver dogs at the County Road 300 property in Lake Panasoffkee, the Sumpter County Sheriff's Office had done some digging, though at the time, they hadn't found anything of note. In their coverage of the announcement, the Times reported that a search of the county records indicated that Earl Pippin, despite saying he didn't co-own any properties with Sandra, was in fact a co-owner of her property located at 887 County Road 482A. At the time, investigators had little to say about Pippin, other than noting that he had told them during an interview that he'd last seen Sandra prior to Christmas. Later in the week, on Thursday, January 12th, police officially unsealed Sandra's home and removed the 24-hour surveillance, turning the house over to her family. Asked about this decision and whether or not they'd learned anything new, spokesperson Paula McDonald told The Times, quote, "Unfortunately, it doesn't mean we're any closer. We're trying to get that neighborhood to return to some sense of normalcy. Certain things are being observed and talked about that aren't in the interest of the public to release. Hopefully, next week, we'll have more information." End quote. By this point, police had interviewed virtually everyone Sandra worked with, but were finding it difficult to learn much about her private life. McDonald did note, however, that following the announcement of the $50,000 reward, the number of tips called in had risen considerably. Sandra's ex-husband, Luke Horvath, someone who would have some insight into her life, spoke to The Times and expressed his concern, saying, quote, "I wouldn't put it beyond Sandra to just take off, except the part that doesn't make sense is that she didn't call work. She was the consummate professional." End quote. 3 weeks after Sandra was reported missing, friends, family, and coworkers organized a candlelight vigil to be held at her Temple Terrace home. Susan Horton was the driving force behind the event, hoping that it would raise awareness for the case and also assist in keeping the story in the headlines. She later told The Times, quote, "The first week I spent numb. I'm still being hopeful. I'm still using the present tense. Somebody knows something. It's just, you can't chalk it up to a middle life crisis or whatever. It's not at all in her makeup. The number one goal is to get her back in the newspaper and on TV. If she is somewhere, we want her to know lots of people are missing her and caring about her." End quote. Approximately 100 people showed up for the vigil, including Sandra's cousin, Jim Moore, who was making his second trip down from North Carolina. Jim explained that he and Sandra had maintained a tight relationship over the years, saying, quote, "We are so anxious just to get an inkling of what has happened. She is a genuinely caring person and just so reliable, so dependable. Her word is her bond. I have never known her to fail to meet her responsibilities. We were very close. She talked to me about events in her life freely. We are a fairly large family, and she is by far the best of us all." End quote. Jim explained that he had last seen his cousin 3 months earlier and that the two kept in touch. If she were planning to go off somewhere, she'd certainly have told him. During the vigil, friends tied a yellow ribbon around a tree in Sandra's front yard and listened to some of her favorite music, including Janis Joplin's Me and Bobby McGee. Neighbor Suzanne Spiner acknowledged that everyone who knew Sandra cared about her and wanted to see the search come to the best possible end it could, telling The Times, quote, "We just want to say together that we want our neighbor home." End quote. Despite all of the efforts being exerted by friends, family, and investigators, little ground was being made in the search. Asked about the status of the case, Paula McDonald explained that more than 1,400 hours had already been dedicated to the investigation, and while there was no suspect, they were speaking to persons of interest. Asked directly about Earl Pippin, McDonald noted that he was cooperating with investigators and at the time was neither a suspect nor a person of interest. McDonald also confirmed that investigators had moved on and were now searching the County Road 482A property that Pippin shared with Sandra. She emphasized how important it was to keep people aware of the case, explaining, quote, "We need to make sure this lady's photo stays out there, as we don't have a lot of new information to share. It's important that we let the public know we need their assistance." End quote. Unfortunately, some 3 weeks after Sandra had last been seen, no solid leads had yet developed. All of that, however, was about to change. On Wednesday, February 1st, the Temple Terrace Police Department called a press conference to make an announcement and to request further assistance from the public. During the course of their investigation, detectives had subpoenaed Sandra's financial records and quickly discovered activity on two of her bank accounts, which appeared to have taken place in and around the weekend of her disappearance. Reportedly, someone had withdrawn cash from ATM machines at two separate locations, utilizing Sandra's bank card. It should be noted that bank card was not recovered during a search of the home and was assumed to be in the missing purse. McDonald explained that they were able to obtain video and still photographs taken by security cameras in the ATMs and had been waiting for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to enhance the images before announcing them to the public. While at the time, they wouldn't reveal the total number of transactions, the date and times of withdrawals, nor the exact locations where the ATMs were used, they did release the video and still framed images, which showed a masked man driving up to one ATM and walking up to a different one and using Sandra's card. Based on an analysis of the footage, police described the suspect as a white male with a large, stocky build and dark hair on his arms. No visible rings, jewelry, or tattoos were captured by the cameras. The man is seen wearing dark-colored pants, a plaid patterned shirt, and a green mask resembling a ski mask. The man may also have been wearing a neck brace or some kind of a collar which moves stiffly in the footage. In the drive-up footage, the suspect is seen behind the wheel of a light-colored, mid-sized, American-made four-door vehicle, though they could not at the time define what kind of car it was. Detectives noted that the vehicle description matched very closely to Sandra's own Buick Park Avenue, though they didn't have enough evidence to confirm whether or not the suspect may have been driving her car. Investigators noted that they had previously shown the images to Sandra's co-workers, but no one had been able to identify the man seen making the withdrawals. Members of Sandra's family, also present at the conference, expressed their concern, saying that images of the masked suspect were chilling and didn't bode well for the possibility of Sandra still being alive. In response, they had their own announcement, stating that they were increasing the reward for information from $50,000 to $75,000. It was hoped at the time that this new evidence might help break the case open, and the increased reward might make people a little more likely to come forward with possible identifications of the suspect. Reporters asked a series of questions during the conference, with the Tampa Tribune inquiring as to whether or not it was possible that the suspect may have forced Sandra to accompany him to the ATMs, to which McDonald replied, quote, "I don't think anyone is willing to speculate on that. At this point, the only thing we know for sure is that this man accessed her finances," end quote. In response to this conference, the number of tips being received again increased, giving investigators a whole slew of people to look into. Unfortunately, while behind the scenes, detectives had a lot going on and several different avenues to explore, for the most part, the case began growing quiet, at least in the eyes of the public. The rest of February would pass without any new leads or information being released. In hopes of revitalizing the case and keeping it going, Susan Horton organized a gathering to take place on March 24th to celebrate what would have been Sandra's 60th birthday. The party, set to be held at one of Sandra's favorite restaurants, drew in a large number of friends and family, who shared stories about the missing woman and how positively she had affected all of their lives. Susan achieved her goal, as multiple outlets turned up for the event and published new articles about the case, bringing Sandra back to the front pages. While some were beginning to lose hope, the Temple Terrace police were about to reveal even more information. On Friday, March 30th, investigators held another press conference, this time to say that they were releasing a composite sketch depicting the man who had been seen accessing Sandra's bank accounts. According to McDonald, detectives were able to utilize information about one of the ATMs, which led them to a witness who not only saw the masked man using the machine, but also saw him before he put on the green ski mask. Why the witness didn't come forward sooner was unknown, but after speaking with police, the witness described the man as a white male in his mid-30s to early 40s, weighing between 215 and 245 pounds. At the time, he had dark brown hair and was clean-shaven. McDonald also revealed the two locations in which the ATMs were used, citing them as Wachovia Bank on North 56th Street and Tampa Bay Federal Credit Union on North Florida Avenue. Wachovia Bank is south of Sandra's home, nearly halfway between the house and the Axe offices, also located along North 56th Street. The Tampa Bay Federal Credit Union is in the opposite direction, approximately 7 miles northwest of Sandra's house. At the time, Investigators wouldn't reveal details of the transactions, though they shared the composite and implored everyone who recognized the man to contact them. Less than 4 days later, Lieutenant Chris Jeffords told the Times they had received more than 60 calls suggesting possible identities for the masked man. Some of them, however, weren't all that strong, with Jeffords noting that at least one person had called in to suggest that a recent contestant on Jeopardy resembled the suspect. While Jeffords doubted a connection, he simply explained, "You just never know. All leads need to be investigated to the best of our abilities." While it had been hoped that the composite and new information about the banks would speed the process along, investigators were very quiet over the next few months. Sandra's story fell out of the headlines again. Newspaper articles grew fewer and further between, and to many it seemed, all hope might be drying up. Then, in September of 2006, more than 9 months since Sandra had last been seen, the Temple Terrace police decided to release more information about the case, and much to the surprise of those who had been following it closely, they'd name a person of interest as well. On Wednesday, September 13th, investigators spoke to the media and for the first time revealed that while they had found no signs of forced entry at Sandra's home, an examination of her car showed a significant amount of blood in the trunk of her Buick. Additional testing had confirmed that the blood was Sandra's. Detectives also confirmed for the first time that the vehicle captured on ATM surveillance footage was in fact Sandra's car, confirming that the suspect had returned the car to her garage after withdrawing money. Spokesman Michael Dunn stated that while the blood, video, and financial information is enough to suspect foul play, the case was remaining that of a missing person for the time. Dunn also announced that the FBI had been brought in to assist with the investigation. In addition to this, Dunn explained that they were officially naming Earl Cranston Pippin III as a person of interest in the investigation. Dunn described Pippin's relationship with Sandra as very intimate, saying that it had begun 5 years prior to her disappearance. Pippin, who had been married for 20 years, was now in the process of a divorce after his wife Gail filed a month earlier in August. Since the filing, Pippin was living at a property he owned in Lake Panasoffkee. Dunn also noted that, at the time, they had no information linking Pippin to the ATM surveillance videos. So, why were they naming Pippin a person of interest after all this time? Well, according to Dunn, 2 weeks before the press conference, Pippin had hired a lawyer and immediately ceased all communication and stopped cooperating with investigators. In addition to this, Pippin was reportedly listed on Sandra's will as the sole beneficiary of her estate, valued at nearly $3 million. Next week, in part two of our examination of the disappearance of Sandra Prince, we'll get into a lot more detail about Pippin, his relationship with Sandra, inconsistencies in his story, and the reaction of friends and family to his being named as a person of interest. We'll also discuss the possibility that more than one person was involved in this crime, an alleged motive of greed and jealousy revolving around someone close to Sandra, two separate excavations conducted at a house that was under construction when she vanished, how a $6,000 painting may have fostered dissent in Sandra and Pippin's relationship, the offering of the largest reward in Temple Terrace history, and the revelation that someone else close to the case may have more information than they've shared. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers. Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brekeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That concludes part one of our look into the disappearance of Sandra Prince. I know unsolved cases can be frustrating and difficult, but as we've seen here today with the arrest of Nicole Rice, justice may be hard to find, but it's never completely out of reach. Again, I want to thank you all for listening and supporting the show, and I hope you'll join me next week for part two of The Disappearance of Sandra Prince.